From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us. Welcome, everybody, to yet another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me, as always, are my two partners in crime. Firstly, I'm assuming in London, the captain himself, Giles Morgan, are you there?
I am, Grant. I'm here back in Wandsworth. It's bloody freezing, and the planes seem to be landing somewhere very, very close to me, because every now and then there seems to be, I'm deafened, so apologies if there's the ambient music of Qantas landing.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Just think of all those smiling, cheerful Australians stepping out into a miserable English winter, and that'll put a smile back on your face, John.
Yeah, that does cheer me up enormously, actually.
and presumably, either in or nearby the lake is Roger.
Yeah, I'm just on the lake here in Como. It's a nice day. The rain has stopped. It's all good in the world.
How pleasant. And we should also point out that producer James is back sunning himself in the Caribbean while we all worry about the winter. Can we get a hello from James?
He's always on mute.
No, when he does.
It is the best place for him, I think.
Yeah, mute. Good point. Well, gents, look, we have a fabulous guest this week who I've been looking forward to talking to all week. I'm going to let Giles introduce him shortly. But in the meantime, another fun and incident-packed week. Plenty to talk about. I don't think we have time for a full goal on goal because we'll be here sitting here all day. But let's let the captain go first. Giles, anything grab your eye this week?
Well, it is astonishing. We're living in a political world where politicians seem to be able to get away with absolutely anything and everything and continue on their merry way. But certainly in the British sports industry, recently we've had two CEOs who've... unfortunately for them, their past has perhaps caught up with them, or situations have caught up. And they've unfortunately both been in a situation where they've not actually taken the jobs they were hired to do, which is astonishing, really. And of course, there's so much one could say about it, and one has to be sensitive in these matters. But at a time when sport, as we talk about on this podcast all the time, is clamoring for strong leadership, great leaders, to help an industry that has got commercial challenges. My God, talk about shooting yourself in the foot. We seem to be living it's a bit chaotic at the moment, Grant.
I would substitute shooting oneself in the foot for the slightly more apropos falling on one's sword, but that's another issue altogether. But look, I mean, I guess we're talking about David Pemsel in the first instance. And the second one, I'm a bit lost. What am I missing?
Well, there's been a similar situation with UK Athletics, which we don't need to particularly go into, but it's just very indicative. And if you think of the amount of scandal that has besmirched sport over the last few years. I'm thinking FIFA, I'm thinking, well, we could go on and on and on. Mm-hmm. It just feels that we've got this wonderful industry where everybody bangs on all the time about how powerful sport is, how global sport is, and how it has the power to change society and get fat kids off the sofa and get people running, not, you know, taking their car to work, and all these good things about sport, which we all very much bang the drum for. And then we seem to sort of, the industry just doesn't seem to quite get away with getting away from scandal. That's kind of really all I can say on it, actually.
Well, look, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. And I just pose the question, because from when you read, you know, autobiographies or biographies of sporting greats of the past, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever, and at the front of my mind at the moment, I have Babe Ruth sitting front and center. You know, you realize that these guys were just absolute lunatics. I mean, drinking, womanizing, gambling, all of this stuff. And, you know, this is a human condition. This isn't a condition of the times. This is something that has gone on forever. And, you know, I think that it's not going to stop. It feels like it's getting worse, but only because of text messaging and social media and this massive desire on the press to bring the moral hammer down on anyone they can. And, you know, I think it's a societal problem. I mean,
I agree with that.
Everyone is entitled to a private life, let's face it, right? And who amongst us is without sin and can safely cast that stone?
Well, speaking for myself, I can.
Well,
I can.
Obviously, but only because you ran out of stones a long time ago, Charles. you know, look, are these events on the nose? Of course they are. But they're private issues, and I understand the arguments about if people are going to lead organizations, et cetera, et cetera. But I would imagine that if someone took a magnifying glass and a fine tooth comb to the lives of some of the journalists who exposed these stories, they wouldn't make for any different reading. They'd just have a smaller audience because the people aren't as famous. Roger, I heard you agreeing with me in the background, which makes a change.
there's two or three different elements to this, and we probably should break it down a wee bit. Has humanity always had these frailties? 100%. Are they now just coming to light more often because of technology? And yes, and frankly, that's why you get such a low quality of politician these days, because everybody smart knows that in the public eye, it's likely that any skeletons will come out. I think, you know, to be specific, certainly on the English Premiership appointment, we could talk about it in a couple of ways that make it more than just, you know, Puritan reaction, which I think we all agree is probably not the best and certainly not the most coherent for all of us. He was, remember, this is the second candidate for the chief executive. The first one, a woman, apparently took the job, had her first kind of like meeting, whether it was informal or not, with the group of chairmen, and smelt the room and realized that maybe she was in the wrong movie. And we keep coming back to this and say that sport is not such an easy thing to manage. And I think she quickly realized that Rainbow was not for her, whether that's because it's overly misogynist or laddish or maybe too close-minded. I don't know, but she backed away, and maybe that was the right decision. He then, after an incredibly long second search by a new set of headhunters, was proclaimed as Mr. Modern. I wouldn't say Mr. Hipster, but let's say Mr. Modern. Came from The Guardian, which kind of like fits that brand, and was presented by Mr. Buck, the head of the nomination committee of the Premier League. He comes from Chelsea, chairman of Chelsea, as the man of integrity that we have been seeking for so long. Now, when you present somebody like that, you got to make damn sure they haven't got anything in their closet, and he did. Now, in terms of these things happen, relationships can go bad. We've all been there, you know, the wrong moment, the wrong timing. I think his is slightly different from that. That's what you read in these texts as sexist hunting and predatory behavior. There's no other way to describe that. And the fact that he is from The Guardian, when we're in the middle of an election campaign that is particularly fierce and brutal, where The Guardian and The Daily Mail are just as antagonistic as the Labour and the Conservatives. He there was no choice. He had to go. You know, for the stakeholders of the Premier League, they had no choice. He would have been damaged goods forever and a day. So I think that's the reality of this one. I kind of think, seeing what he's done, and somebody who knows that to run a sports organization, the first quality you have to have and is trust with those stakeholders, and be able to go to every single club chairman, look them in the eye and say something along the lines of, you know, all of this is compromise. 20 clubs can't all have the same view. You have to give and take. Do you trust me that in the main, I will try and find balance that's fair for 20, where you all have to give up something? That's a job of trust. Now, so when you've got your guy obviously betraying trust to, let's be honest, to his poor wife, first of all, then I don't think that's the right guy.
Well, you know, Roger, you make a good point. I have to say that's very well put. Very well put indeed. I mean, do you wonder, we've talked about pendulum swinging backwards and forwards before. We've talked about the importance of keeping advertisers and sponsors happy. And, you know, Giles, obviously, you know that from the other side of the story. Is there a point, do you think, at which somebody stands up, not in this case, but we get another one of these tales of someone doing something in their private life, and eventually an organization just says, you know what, look, we understand this. We don't condone it, but his private life is his private life. He's the man for this job. We stand behind him. Well, do you think that we'll ever get back to that, or are the demands of the sponsors way too strong? Now, we've seen this with LeBron James and the NBA, that the furore that gets caused. Do you think that pendulum can swing back ever?
Well, I don't know. None of us do. We're living in a time, and there's a sort of liberalism, but there's a kind of media liberalism which feels very close to a kind of, maybe fascism's too strong a word, but I suspect pendulums do swing back. I'm sure they.
Is that pendula?
Oh my God! I've never thought
someone's.
I think you're a bit of a pendulum. but yes, pendula swinging. Wow, that could be the title of a new album.
You know where that comes from. That's what you call a good Catholic education. We all had to do our Latin.
Yes, there's no words for that. So going back to the pendulum and pendular, I suspect there will be a swing back at some point. It does feel everything is enormously extreme. And there is, as always with these things, there's a balance. There's individual circumstances, as Roger put very well, which I think we all understand. And then there is a sort of, but people do deserve a private life. And gosh, as you say, quite rightly, if you go back in history, great leaders, sports people, musicians over the centuries, colour is something that surrounds a lot of those lives, and we almost celebrate those. So there's some sort of sense, I've said this before, I feel that we live in a very weirdly Orwellian dystopian world at the moment.
Well, and incredibly hypocritical, let's face it.
Yes.
I think Giles is right here. I think once you're obliged, because that's what the society does to us now, once you're obliged to not make any mistakes around getting somebody's pronouns wrong, about saying somebody's overweight or not, or say, what, and we're not allowed to say that anymore. We are creating a circumstance where a mistake is fatal. In the old days, everybody knew everybody was flawed. And so that meant when something came out, they cut you a break a little bit, you know? Yeah. And you know, this is what happens when you set these ridiculous standards. And you know, you've said it before, Grant, about how sponsors always kind of like look immediately for what is the politically correct response, rather than, you know, what I think we're alluding to here is that maybe sponsorship should, you know, take a lead in this and realize that, you know, some of the most interesting human stories in sport is humanity, is around flawed individuals who succeed despite their flaws, you know? So let's embrace that everybody's got flaws and then move on. And you know, I think that's what they should do. And maybe we'll come on to it. Maybe we've got time before the guest about, you know, what the main issue is here, which is, by the way, the biggest sports franchise rights holder in Europe is without a CEO again, when everybody thinks that sport is going through the start of a recession, maybe mild, maybe a soft landing, but a lot of us think a hard landing. And where is the leader at the center of that to try and find some kind of like safe path to get us through the other end? I think that's the question I'd like to hear, you know, yourself and Giles think about, because, you know, that guy's gone, you know, like forget about him. It's now, what is the job description for the English Premier League chief exec?
Well, I mean, that's my question about the pendulum, because to me, the pendulum has to swing back, because you're right. You're not going to be able to find the guy. That, you know, nobody is perfect. And so if that's what you're looking for, if you can only look for a guy or a woman who is perfect, then good luck with that. You know, I think we saw the beginnings of this with the Nike Colin Kaepernick advert. You know, here's a guy who had upset an awful lot of people. It was a moral issue, and although the questionability of the morals depends largely on your political leanings, but still, Nike kind of dipped their toes in the water with running a campaign around him as a flawed individual, as someone who had caused outrage, and it, you know, it didn't play very well. But I suspect that's the thin end of the wedge, and I think at some point, you know, imagine Giles, particularly imagine a couple of years ago or 10 years ago, this last week when, you know, Tiger Woods's troubles began when he drove into that fire hydrant. You know, there's someone that you could have done an advertising campaign based around. Look, this guy has messed up horrendously. He's done some awful things. He's betrayed people, but he's an athlete and he's the best of his generation. He's the best of all time. Blah blah. You know, there is a way, I suspect, that you can you know, acknowledge people's flaws and frailties, and try and say, look, you have to put that to one side, and this is a human being who is subject to the same foibles that we all are.
Well, isn't that the point of storytelling and the oral tradition and the story tradition that human beings have really spent the last 14,000 years doing is telling stories about flaws, about great moments and disaster. And any author will say that you need all of these ingredients, which is not about perfection. In fact, you could argue that imperfection is what makes the perfect story.
Do you know, I hate the fact that that is as good a segue into our guest as it would be possible to have, and I'm going to ruin it right now, because we could have gone straight into our guest then, Giles, and I could have waxed poetically and beautifully segued from one to the other. But I have to get this in before we welcome our guest to the show this week, and that is the absolute sheer excellence of Ford versus Ferrari, or Le Mans 66, I think it's called in the UK. Have either of you gentlemen seen it?
Yeah, I have. Magic.
It is.
I haven't, but I heard it's wonderful.
Rog, it is exhilarating, breathtaking, captivating filmmaking in every way. The acting, Christian Bale is just, he's such a legend. He always is, but Matt Damon's great, the writing's great, the music's great, the racing sequences are just so brilliantly shot. I absolutely loved it, and I would urge anyone who's remotely interested in sport and sporting stories of success and failure and redemption, or just a bloody good movie, should go and watch it.
Yeah, and you know, it actually builds beautifully off the point we were making about narrative. Is you've got in the two protagonists in the movie two very flawed individuals. Yeah. Who come together with a very, very, in fact, it's a perfect analogy for our entire podcast, because you've got the big, nasty corporate in Ford. You've got Ferrari being the kind of the previous giant that is just taking over the world. And then you've got two flawed people who together create something very, very special. But there's nothing politically correct about anything in that film, and it makes it wonderful.
No, it really does.
I never saw it, but I can feel it coming through your voices. My son has seen it and said it's wonderful. I would like just to mention, and this is not new, but I only saw it last week, which was the Grand Tour. You know, the ex-Top Gear guys.
Yes. Yep.
Who did a segment on Jim
they
Clark.
They did a piece on this, yeah.
I think they've done a piece on that as well.
Okay, they did a piece on the GT40 as well.
Yeah, and the Jim Clark thing that it was Richard Hammond that did it.
Yes,
who did it so beautifully and sensitively, and you know, made the case that and on whatever real way that you want to judge the greatest racer of all time, whether that's pole positions, whether that's podiums, wins, Clark or percentage wins, Clark is the best one. And, you know, as I was just watching that, this is a Scottish farmer, you know, a humble man, good looking guy, you know, like the archetypal sports hero, you know, and he dies at 32. And, you know, it was about 10 minutes, that segment. And I was just entranced. And, you know, when you're talking about this film here, I can feel the same stuff.
Well, you'll see the Grand Tour also did a piece, I think Clarkson did it, about this Ford versus Ferrari, the GT40, and that's also an exceptional 10-minute
wonderful
piece. Really, really good. But the movie, I mean, I cannot recommend it strongly enough. It was thrilling, absolutely thrilling. And it, you know, 2.5 hours. It's a long film, but I didn't look at my watch once. So when it ended, I could have sat there for another half an hour. The Irishman, which I've still got on in the background. I started it on Thanksgiving and it's still going in the background.
You don't like it?
Look, it was good, but it wasn't Goodfellas, let's be honest.
Oh, really? Wow. Everybody says it's the masterpiece of his career and everything like that. Mm.
I would take great issue with that. Look, it's not a bad movie. I enjoyed it, but it's a fantastic 2.5 hour movie hidden inside a 3.5 hour movie, I thought.
Hmm. Listen, just before we bring in the guest, and in the same theme of flawed characters and what end of the history books they end up, we have got the news this week, and you know what caught her eye this week. What caught my eye this week was the president of Brescia saying that the marquee signing they had in the summer, Mario Balotelli, was free to go in January after the latest, you know, underperformance and debacle. And I just want to ask you guys this. Now, it's all clear that his career has not been anywhere near where it should have been. I don't think that's in doubt, and in a lot of ways, who cares, to be honest? There's a lot of great players around. I want to ask you this. Does the fact that he, as a young black guy in Italy that was subjected to what we know is quite a lot of significant racism in Italy and Southern Europe and Eastern Europe still, does that justify the fact that he has been maybe so angry, so frustrated, that he's never listened to people like Mourinho, like Mancini, like Brendan Rodgers? All these managers who have tried to put him on the straight and narrow, and he's kind of like more or less spat in everybody's face and is about to end his career at the age of 28, having achieved precisely nothing. Is that a good enough excuse that he was racially abused as a kid?
Roger, I mean, you really want to ask that question immediately before we're going to bring our guest on? I mean, how do we possibly pick that apart in 30 seconds or a minute? I mean, it's a subject for another podcast.
Let's keep it.
Let's save it. Let's park that and talk about it another day, because I think it's a very good and very valid question to ask, and I'm sure, given a bit of time to think about it, we can we can do a much better job of answering.
I agree.
Than we could,
James. Don't cut this out. It's an aid memoir if we leave it in.
There you go. And James, don't cut out the bit about Roger asking you not to cut that out either, because that's a little bit of the magic dust sprinkled gone forever. Okay, well, look, let's get to our guest, because there's been a lot of things that we've talked about here that are really good segues, but I'm going to leave the actual segue to the master himself, Captain Morgan.
Well, our guest this week is to me anyway, one of the real legends of the sports circus, the industry. And he's a rarefied species these days. He's a proper writer. He's a proud Welshman by the name of John Hopkins, or universally known around the world of golf and rugby as Hoppy. And he's genuinely one of the great sports writers, and whose career spans over 50 years working for the Times and Sunday Times in the UK. He covers golf, rugby, the Olympics, you name it, he's covered it at some point. And he now writes for the Global Golf Post, which is a fabulous online publication, but probably can more often be found at Royal Porthcawl Golf Club, either in the fairway or perhaps in the fantastic bar. Anyone who gets a chance to go to the bar at Porthcawl is in for an absolute treat. And a club which boasts, I think, probably the most illustrious rugby backlines of any golf club anywhere in the world. Croeso, John. How are you?
Well, if I told you that I spent the weekend down in Tenby, and I walked along the south beach in Tenby in glorious sunshine, a strong wind, over the weekend with a very attractive blonde on my arm, I think you probably conclude that I've had a pretty good weekend.
Fantastic.
Very interesting.
We could talk about that for a while if you like.
If we asked the attractive blonde, how did her weekend go, though? Would she be similarly effusive?
I'd be very disappointed if she didn't say she enjoyed it as much as I did.
Excellent.
Very good. Well, John, it's fantastic to have you on the show. You are been an old friend of mine during my days in the golf industry. I have a funny anecdote is that John wrote a very nice piece about me after I left HSBC, where in his sort of surmise of my career at HSBC, said it was something of an advantage that I was so crap at golf that helped me build up one of the big golf portfolios. And my mother has kept the piece. She just loves it and keeps it very close to me if I'm getting too big for my boots.
Good. It was a nice piece. It was too long, but it was good fun to do it.
Oh, I didn't mind that. And anyone who talks about me, that's a big advantage. Tell me, John. We're going to ask you a million questions, and I know that Grant, who's a massive golf fan, and Roger, who's sort of taken up golf as a Scotsman again. We've got a lot of questions about sport, but just very quickly, what's your sort of take on the 2019? Golf season that we've had? I know it's not quite done. There's President's Cup to come, but has it been a good year for golf?
Well, I think that as far as I'm concerned, I have been to 43 Opens, almost all in a row, but not quite. And this year's in Northern Ireland was the best. So that gives the year as a whole a bit of a jet-propelled start. I'm not sure that I can settle in this new rhythm of the major championships, one every month. I remember Seve always used to say he had to rest after a major championship because he was simply so tired by the preparation and the extra commitment he put into it. And I think the players do need to rest, and I certainly would prefer the old routing, the old not having one in not beginning in March and not necessarily having one in May and so on. For the same reason as the players. I mean, Justin Rose said, look, I just didn't feel I had time to correct what had gone wrong in the previous championship before I had to start preparing for the next one. And his requirements are obviously very different to mine, but and I would obviously have to get used to it as if I'm going to cover golf, carry on covering golf, and I've got to be there and do what is necessary. But the season isn't quite as stellar. Notwithstanding Tiger's extraordinary win, the season is not quite so stellar as it might have been because it seems a bit jumbled. It's been like an express train that's whizzed through or a Tour de France peloton. You know, 1 minute there's complete silence. Next minute there's a terrific blur of shirts and bicycle wheels, and the next minute all is tranquility again. And I feel the golf season, the professional golf season at any rate, is a bit like that at the moment.
John, it's Roger here.
Hello, Roger.
Hi there, John, and it really is a privilege for me to speak to you. But if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you immediately why you think this year's Open was the best ever when, from my point of view, as a television spectator mind, I found it pretty underwhelming, certainly compared to things like Turnberry 77 and some of the... I need to ask you, with 43 years of experience, what made it so special for you?
First of all, the build-up to the Open, there seemed to be so much more excitement. I mean, there's always a lot of excitement about an Open because it is the oldest major championship. It's the one over here. It's one of my favorite events of the year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In addition to all that, this year was the fact that we were going to Northern Ireland. And it was just such an outpouring of warmth long before we got there. I kept hearing from people like Martin Ebert, who did a brilliant job in redesigning the course, how helpful everybody is. There's a famous lady in golf called Wilma Erskine, who is the, for want of a better word, it's a slightly demeaning term. She's really just the secretary of Royal Portrush Golf Club. But in point of fact, she's probably one of the most powerful sports figures in Northern Ireland. And nobody goes to anywhere near Royal Portrush without being Wilmot, which incidentally means that they will have had a drink or two. She's wonderfully hospitable. She got the event to Northern Ireland virtually on her own, really. She was the first woman to be appointed secretary of a golf course on the open rota, and one of the first to be appointed secretary anywhere. And 25 years ago, she used to say to people, "Welcome to Royal Portrush. We'll be having the Open here soon," just by sheer force of personality. Tim Fincham flew her over to an event in America. Tim Fincham, the former commissioner of the PGA Tour, flew her over as a guest to an event in America as a thank you for all the hospitality that she has given to Americans and for all that she's done for golf. So we've got the build-up to the Open. We've got Wilma Erskine. We've got a terrific golf course. We've got the fact that not a single player, to the best of my knowledge, uttered a word of criticism. Now, that's an extraordinary thing, really, because someone somewhere will generally have a moan about the way they cut the pin on the 15th. It's far too close to the bunker. Or my bunker, the one bunker that he was in on the second hole, hadn't been raked by the caddy of the group ahead. There's always, it's almost impossible not for there not to be a moan, but I honestly and truly did not hear a moan this year. Then there was, and this is really important, the venue, it's a speck of a place. It's got a massive Catherine wheel thingamy, a bit like the thing on the South Bank that goes round, and that stands out for miles away. It's on a curved on a bay, like cup your hand and you get an idea of what I want, what I mean. The traffic you would think would be a nightmare. And point of fact, that was brilliant too. I drove in every day and I was staying perhaps 5 miles away from Portrush in Port Stewart. I never had any delays whatsoever. When the weather turned sour, as it did, and the field in which we were parked turned into a boggy morass, well, they just somehow helped us get out, and nobody really made a fuss of it. The Irish just brought great warmth. And then, finally, the absolute excitement and passion was palpable when Lowry came down the 18th, not on Sunday, when he came down the 18th on Saturday, believe it or not. I mean, he had virtually been given the claret jug on Saturday afternoon. And I was only one of the people who said to him afterwards, "Look, don't you think everybody's getting a bit ahead of themselves?" And he said, "Yes, absolutely. Look, I wish they, I keep telling them it's not over yet." But the excitement that began at about 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon and didn't finish, despite the terrible rain, I got completely soaked on Sunday walking around. But the excitement that was generated and just the feeling of happiness of all these smiling faces. There wasn't a sour face to be seen anywhere. There wasn't a word that was out of place. It just worked. And I've gone on now for a long time, and I've expressed my enthusiasm for it. Now, I accept that Turnberry in Watson Nicholas was terrific. I didn't believe what I was seeing when Tom Watson went so close at Turnberry again in 2009.
Yes,
and I had started to write my intro. This could be the greatest achievement in sport. A man who I believe was 59 then won the Open yesterday, but it didn't happen. And just for the everything that happened, the week of the Open this year made it special.
Yeah, John, I was with you. Roger and I went back and forward about this. I really, really enjoyed the Open this year in Northern Ireland for all the reasons you said. I felt that came through through the TV screen. I mean, I am a big golfer, more so than Rog, so maybe it was that. But you brought up Turnberry. I have to ask you. I was doing my sums, and 43 years ago was 1976. I'm assuming you were there for the duel in the sun, and it would have been obviously one of your formative Open experiences. So I'd just love if you could to take us back to that, which to me is still the greatest man versus man duel in golf history.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to disappoint you because I was at a little event in Canada called the Montreal Olympics, which went on at the same time. Are we talking about 76 or 77?
No, 77. No, 77. I'm looking 77. At the duel in the sun.
Sorry, 77. I was with the Lions on what I christened in the book I wrote, Life with the Lions, the Bad News Tour of New Zealand. So I missed that one as well. I've done every Open starting in 1980, and I did a few Opens in the 70s, but I didn't do the duel in the sun. My recollection of that is based on reading my colleagues, on hearing about it when I came home. And I'm pretty sure that, like you, I would have felt that that was the greatest head-to-head display of golf I would have seen if I had been there. I can't think of anything to rival it in golf. I can think of things like Tiger Woods and Ernie Els in a President's Cup with darkness about to descend, literally. And Els has who was playing Tiger, had a crucial putt to hole in the darkness, and unfortunately it was decided that it should be conceded and the event, I think, should be halved. And the two of them were, at the time, the one and two players in the world. But that was a relatively short thing. I mean, for Jack and Tom to separate themselves from the rest of the field so early on in a 72-hole tournament, I must have made it quite extraordinary.
Hoppy, you talked about the Lions Tour, and having been so vile about my own golf as you were in your piece, I'm going to steer you away to a sport that I was equally crap at, but at least I have a great passion for, which is rugby. And I would imagine, as you look back on your career, and it's been an amazing career in writing over the many years, is something we talk about a lot on this podcast is about characters and about people who really stand out, maybe for athletic performance, but also for their sheer scale of personality. Who are the sort of standouts from golf, rugby, whomever, people that, as you've interviewed them, got to know them probably as friends in your case, because that's the way you operate. Who are your standout that you go, oh, they had something about them that just stood them apart?
Well, I think it wasn't necessarily the sort of person you would think. I mean, Gavin Hastings was talking about Finlay Calder as a really hard man, a man you followed into battle, and I can understand that. But I think, when you ask me that, I think immediately of people like Andy Irvine, with whom I spent a very pleasant day writing a piece for the Sunday Times about how he kicked the ball and how he ran and so on and so forth. And I actually got into my own short, or got into a pair of rugby shorts to run around with him and to kick the ball with him. And
fantastic.
And fortunately I was kept out of the piece, but the point was I just got to know him well. And to this day, we come across each other quite often at golf events because he's always on about, he loves his golf as well. Let me just take you back to the 5 or 6 years that I had on the Sunday Times when I was, the Black Prince, and Vivian Jenkins, great VGJ Jenkins, was the rugby correspondent. The Sunday Times in those days, in the early 70s, would allow me to do almost anything. If I'd said I wanted to go and interview someone in Australia, they'd say, well, you better find a couple of other stories, but off you go. So I had lovely occasions when I went, for example, down to South Wales for 3 days, and I went in search of the Pontypool front row. And I and Chris Smith, a wonderful photographer, went to each of them in their place of work, and I made a nuisance of myself by asking questions, and Chris took some lovely pictures, and then in the evening we took each of them out to dinner. And it's very interesting when work has finished, so to speak, when I have closed my notebook and we're sitting and we're just talking man to man, it's very interesting to know which of them is interested enough, either in me, but more so perhaps in Chris Smith, to ask questions. And a number of them did want to know about Chris's cameras, you know, the lenses, the adjustments that you have to make and so on. But it was over those dinners. And I Bobby Windsor was terrific. Charlie Faulkner was great. Graham Price pushed me in the swimming pool in Fiji on the way back from the Lions tour. I have lots of what you might call low level memories. I bow to no one in my admiration for Alan Wynne, for example, now. And I thought that Phil Bennett was terrific, and Bill Beaumont. What did I christen Bill? Doesn't really matter, but a cartoon character, and I used it in the Times until one day he took me to one side and said, John, I'd rather you didn't do that. And there was a look about him that suggested to me that if I didn't stop
and
doing
you didn't
it,
anymore,
he might fill me in. Lovely man. I mean, he and I bump into each other at Lytham, where he's a member, Royal Lytham. And I was up there not so long ago, and I clambered up a sandhill, and there he was, standing with his son, Josh, and I nudged him, and he turned to me with that sort of puggish, rather careworn face that he's got now, and a big smile creased it. And he said, oh, hello, John, how are you? And I saw him the next day, and he said, oh, John, I read your piece in the Times this morning. I thought it was quite good. Who wrote it for you? So these are not earth-shattering memories, but colliding with people at a lower level on simple things such as going and doing a story with them, although you'd hardly say that spending 14 weeks in New Zealand, 112 days when it rained on 77 of them in 1977, and I christened it the Bad News Tour, and you'd hardly say that 10 weeks, 70 days on tour with the Lions in 1980, which was a completely different thing, and you'd hardly say that I wasn't submerging myself in those particular events. It was those people on those tours. Mike Slemon was a character, an Irishman who was unbelievably superstitious. Had to get into bed exactly the same way, crossing the floor of his bedroom. And if he had a flagstone floor or he had squares on the floor, he had to get out of bed and go onto each square in exactly the same way in the evening as he had done when he got into it in the morning and so on. I mean, as I say, these are not the sort of memories of that will cause people to, but they're my memories, little memories, very, very warm memories. And one of the favorite memories is simply not of an occasion, but just of the friendship that is formed with these people when you go off and, well, certainly when you go on a Lions tour. I mean, Lions tours now are nothing like they were then for the journalists. We were traveling with the players in 77 and 80, and we were very close to them. We saw them. We often, not always, but often stayed in the same hotel. But these are lifelong memories. As I say, Beaumont's remained a friend, and Roger Utley, David
Duckham.
And
was there a code of conduct in terms of, in those days, it's a bygone time, where you travelled with them, everybody was on tour, and there was just, an unsaid code of what was or wasn't going to be reported?
Yeah. Now, this is a very interesting question, Giles. And before I went in 77, I thought, well, how do we work this out? You know, we're going to be with them. We're going to see things which perhaps nobody else will know about, and perhaps they won't want them to know about. So I wrote to a man called H.B. Toft, Bert Toft, who had been the Observer's rugby correspondent before Cliff, who was doing it when I was around, and certainly before Clem. And he wrote me an absolutely wonderful letter. I said, how do I become a rugby correspondent? What do I do? How do I operate? And in the course of it, he said to me that when you're on tour, what people tell you, you must keep to yourself. But what you see, you are entitled to talk about to other people because you never know who else has seen it. But most of all, he said, if whatever it is that has gone on is not affecting that person's play on the field, then whatever you do, put a sock in it. If, however, as a result of something that you know to be going on, off, so to speak, off the field, a player is playing like a drain, then the implication was, well, you've got to address that issue and say, perhaps, in some circuitous way, that his form is affected by other things or something like that. But that was the best piece of advice, and I had that, and I took that with me in 77. And on the whole, although the Lions were far from saints, some of the antics that Mike Burton and co. had got up to in 74 with the Lions in South Africa, well, those days were still around. But I would not write about those because of what Bertolt told me to do or not to do.
But it's so fascinating that you bring that up, John. There's a couple of things I want to just unpack from that. First of all, you know, that code, if you want to call it for the journalists back then, is a complete dichotomy of where we are today. You know, today it seems as though it's all about trying to find that thing that someone has done in private or said in private and bringing it out into the public domain, because that's how you get the clicks and the eyeballs and all this nonsense, which is such a shame. And that, I think that's why when you talk about your little memories about you know, moments that you've shared with these guys, I think as a fan that you think of them as small memories, but to me, as someone who grew up idolizing a lot of these players, hearing just tiny stories about them as human beings, as men away from the game, It brings a piece of realism to something that exists in your mind, exists in a fantasy. And there's nothing gives me a warmer heart than hearing that these guys that you idolize on the field are lovely guys off the field. I mean, that, I think, to the fan is the best thing you can ever hope for.
Yes, I think that I was lucky. I was still doing it in an amateur era, firstly. And secondly, I was working for what most people thought of as a good paper, the Sunday Times. And thirdly, of course, they had the money to allow me to go off and do it. But I remember ringing Colin Meads. I mean, I was in 77, I was 28, 30, something like that. He was a bit older, but he was still the mighty Colin Meads. And it was a very humble man who answered the phone, and I said, here I am. I wonder if I could come and interview. And he said, no, mate, you can come. You stay where you are. I'll come into town early on such and such a morning when I have to come in anyway. And where would you like to meet? He said to me. And I was completely bowled over by this, but I simply said, well, we'll meet in our hotel and in where the Lions were staying. And Colin Meads and I sat down. We had an hour, and I think it could have gone on longer. That was charming. In 77, I remember ringing Tani Norton, the captain of the All Blacks, against whom the Lions were playing. And I wondered what sort of reception I'd get from him too. I didn't have to go through minders. I didn't have to go through a manager. I didn't have to offer to pay anything into a charity. I didn't have to do anything. I simply picked up the phone, asked to speak to him, and arranged to go and spend a day with him too. And I have a picture, of which I'm very proud, of him giving me a piggyback over a particularly muddy bit of a field outside his house because I had street shoes on and he was a big All Black and he didn't want me to get my street shoes and my smart jacket dirty and muddy. This is the level of memory I have, but these are the people who were, I mean, massive heroes at the time, massive figures in their sport, in their country, who turned out to be really, really nice. And the way that things have changed now could possibly be demonstrated by something that happened to me not that many years ago, but about, let's say, for argument's sake, 10 years ago. I rang the office And they said to me, and I said, oh, it's Hoppy here. I'm at such and such an event. Give me an idea of wordage for tomorrow's paper. And they said, ah, Hoppy, hello, how are you, etc. Well, what's the story? And I said, well, it's the third day of a tournament. Lee Westwood is leading. Phil Price from Wales is close behind. Blah, blah, blah. And they said, with a sense of urgency in the word, yeah, Hoppy, but what's the story? And I said, well, I haven't got a story. If we want a real story, I've got an account of yesterday's play or today's play, which I hope will be interesting. But if by a story you want to know whether Lee Westwood is smoking pot or whether he's having an affair with someone else's wife or whether somebody was caught altering their card, if you want any of those, then, I mean, I'll do my best to try and find something, but I can pretty much guarantee I won't be able to. And they said, well, John, look at it like I said, if you've got a story, you can have as many words as you like for that story. But if you've just got an account of a generally soft day's play in a not terribly interesting, but not completely dull tournament, well, that's a different matter. You know, probably got 250 words. But if you've got a story, and I emphasize the word story, we can give you 700 words or 1,000 words, depending upon how good it is. And that brought home to me how things have changed. Now, that was, to be absolutely fair, that was probably 15 years ago. But contrast that, when I was writing about golf, with what had been going on 15 or 20 years before that in the sports that I liked. And that attitude, the most important thing is the story. You know, I've often heard people saying, or the office have been on, they're desperate for a back page lead. In other words, a story that they think they can put, or they can put, onto what they think is the most widely read part of the sports section, in this case of the Times, namely a back page lead. Now, often it would be football, but quite often it was rugby. And if I came up with one in golf, they'd say, wow, John, well done. But it's got to be a story. It can't just be a well-written Bernard Darwin-like or Peter Ryde-like or the wonderful Pat Ward Thomas-like account of a gentle day. It's got to be a story.
John, I'm really, really enjoying this for a couple of reasons. When I was involved in sport in the front line, I got to see very closely the importance of the sports journalist, not just as that person who had the relationships, but often the person who was the bridge between players and new clubs. There was that relationship that you've described so beautifully that is absolutely not there anymore. And it's not there for two reasons. As you say, there isn't the money to pay for that kind of journalism anymore. But more importantly, the clubs and the stars themselves are no longer wanting to be generous with their time because they've got their own social media strategy and commercialization of that on Instagram or on the Players Tribune and everything like that. So young guys that came up in your area and that you kind of like mentored and you took them through because they were ultimately going to be the people that came after you. That no longer happens anymore. A lot of sports journalists these days don't even get out of the office. They're just scraping the newspapers and social media and they're writing pieces. What would you say to a young person today who's listening to this, has got the passion to write about these sports stories at the level you've told us? Would you encourage them or would you say that it's a career that is going nowhere?
Well, I certainly wouldn't say it's a career going nowhere because for them it's their career. And I wouldn't want to be dismissive of their career. But I'd say what Hemingway said to Myra Gellhorn when... they were both covering the Spanish Civil War. He said to her, she said, look, what am I going to write? How am I going? I don't quite know what to do here. And he simply said to her two words, be there. Red Smith, the great American sports writer on the New York Times, said the same thing. And I would say the same thing to any young kid. If you possibly can get there, there's no flavor, there's no real excitement from sitting in an office. listening to or watching a football match on your computer, or listening to a commentary on the radio, or watching it on television, however exciting it might be, it doesn't compare with actually being there. I mean, the most exciting moments of my life, without a shadow of doubt, and you're going to ask me which sport and where and so on, but they've been when I've been there, whatever there is. Because you've got to go there. You can't write. You can't really thrill the reader and engage the reader, I don't think, if you haven't been there, because you don't really know what it's like. You're plucking phrases from other people. You're imagining what it's like. But when you're really there and you've metaphorically got mud on your face because the player has kicked his boots and mud in your face, or you've got blood on your hand because someone has been bleeding and they've left the field and just it's dripped onto your notebook as they go past. Or when you're in the eerie of the Millennium Stadium and suddenly these wonderful Welsh songs and the national anthem wells up all around you. All that's denied you if you don't go there. So be there. Those are the two words I would say. Now, I know that papers increasingly want to pay for it, and the accountants are saying, look, we haven't got the money, and why do you need to go? Why do we need to send so many people and all that? But I would say, if you really want to get the absolute enjoyment out of what you're doing today, whatever it is, whatever sport, just be there.
John, I wanted to ask you something around that whole be there. And you know, the guy said, I'm not much of a golf fan, but I actually am. And I would like to go back to Turnberry in 77. And I was a young man at that time. I would have been 12, I think. And, you know, the thing that struck me about that was the 18th, right? He blocks his drive and puts it in the rough. Watson down the fairway, puts it stone cold dead in his second shot, the approach to Watson. So he's won it. So this guy, Jack Nicklaus, regardless of that, finds the ability to put it on the green and sink that putt. Now, that remains for me one of the greatest examples of driven will to never give up that I've ever seen in sport.
Well, that's part of the excitement and the magic of Watson and Nicklaus. I mean, Watson said later, I knew that Jack would hold the putt. I just knew he would. He's such a great competitor. I walked up to the green and I had to prepare myself for the fact that he would hold the putt, and I hadn't won it, and it wasn't over. And likewise, when Watson's famous chip in on at Pebble Beach,
17th.
A few years later on the 71st hole, Nicklaus said, went up to him later and said, in effect, "Well done, you little son of a bitch," and you do it. You know, they had such respect for one another, but they also knew they had such the minds of champions that they just simply knew that they had to come back. You could only have one absolutely final ultimate winning shot, and that is the one that literally did win the thing. And if the event hasn't finished and you have any kind of a chance to match whatever your rival shot is, well, you're going to hold it. You're simply going to do it. And that's part of what separates them from other American professionals and separates amateurs from us. You know, you know that there's a chance that however well you play the hole or you hit a shot, the man you're competing against is going to play at least as well and possibly even better.
John, there's one place that to me brings all these threads we're talking about together, and that is the excitement of being there, the extraordinary performances year after year, and the press, and that's the Masters at Augusta. And you know, I was very, very fortunate last year. My father and I were there for his 80th birthday, and we were given a tour of the new media center there at Augusta National. And they were telling us the story of how the Masters
Humble
began.
Humble building, isn't it? Just a bit of a shack, really.
it's remarkable. but they told us the story of how the whole thing began. And for those listening who don't know the story, back in the early 1930s, when the tournament started, Augusta was a railroad stop, literally on the way back from Florida spring training, and all the press had been down from New York in Florida for the baseball spring training, and to get publicity for the tournament, they would all stop in Augusta on the way back before on the way to New York, and so the organizers of the Masters would roll the red carpet out for the media and really, really go to town and make this a very special place for them to want to stop, knowing that that would give them great coverage of the tournament, and I think the rest is history. But seeing that new media center and seeing how the press are just taken the most wonderful care of for the week. I mean, they really don't need to leave that building for the entire week. Everything is laid on for them. Throw in the excitement that is generated in the Masters every year, and you have this perfect storm of journalists being there, as you said, being in the moment, being really looked after, being enthusiastic about an event, and having one of, I think, the most consistently exciting events in sports happening year after year after year. There always seems to be a story. How much for us reading this at home, because it I don't know, there's something about the reporting on the Masters that is different to other tournaments to me. And how much of that do you think is down to how comfortable and happy the journalists are, and how much of it is down to the fact
that... I don't think any of it is down to the comfort in the literal sense of the word. I think a lot of it is down to the fact that when you go there, obviously you keep... Those of us who are lucky enough to keep on writing about golf go there year after year after year. So your knowledge of the lore, L-O-R-E, of Augusta is increased. You have personal experiences. You become more engaged with the place. You see more people. You get to know things. And that affects your writing. That infects your writing. And I'm not surprised to hear that you think that the standard of writing is different. I would like to think that on the whole, overall, the standard of writing is probably better from the Masters than almost any other golf event, for the reason I've just mentioned. And incidentally, one other sign of the modern times is that in that magnificent building, which is a bit like a Marriott hotel, there's what they call the lecture theater or the amphitheater, where we all sit and so on, and there's room for 195 journalists or something in rows, and we each row is on a separate tier and so on, so it rises. There are a considerable number of journalists who will not leave that building and take, actually it's not even a walk, if you're not, you can walk, but they are so fussy at Augusta National, they provide you with buggies and things. And there will always be buggies waiting at the press center to take you across to the course, with a journey of about 3 or 4 minutes. They'd rather that was done than stray journalists who might get into trouble and might poke their nose into something that they're not supposed to poke their nose into on the way. So you don't even have to walk to get to the golf course. You obviously have to walk around the golf course because it's one of the few major championships where journalists are not allowed inside the ropes. It provides a very clean canvas for photographers because all you see is the caddy in his white overalls with a green cap and the player alongside him. If the other are other people in the picture, then it's probably the other player and his caddy. But my point is, they are there, but they're not really there. So I'm coming back to what I was saying before about to get the most out of sport, you've got to be, to do the best job of writing about sport, you've got to be there. And that means getting out of the media center anywhere, actually, and getting onto the golf course or onto the side of the tennis court or onto the touchline of the rugby pitch or wherever it is, and seeing and hearing. Some of the most enjoyable moments have been when I've been able to roam around. And I'm standing on a tee, and up comes Nick Faldo and Fanny Simpson, for example. And I can earwig. I'm 6 or 8 feet away from them. I can earwig the conversation between Faldo says, "What do you think, Fanny?" And Fanny says, "Well, maybe a 6-iron, but perhaps you could take a bit off a 5, and don't forget the wind is coming from the left," and so on. And a lot of that cannot be incorporated in one's report the next day. However, you happen to be on a tee, and it's at a very important stage of a big event, and a decision made on that tee has an outcome on the bearing. Well, I can present, I hope, in reasonably readable fashion, 2 pretty damn good paragraphs about that exchange, and I'll feel that I've taken people there. I've taken the reader who's sitting in Hemel Hempstead or Llandudno or Conway or Ochterada, wherever. I've taken the reader momentarily and put them on the tee of that tournament, and then I've told them why the exchange that I've just described has been important and significant. Pat Ward Thomas, the great golf writer on The Guardian, arguably the best descriptive writer about golf that there's ever been, said to me years and years ago when I went up to Norfolk to write a piece about him, he having retired, his advice to me was, John, you've always got to tell the reader which way the wind is blowing. And I've never forgotten that. And Jamie Corrigan, my friend, and the young journalists of today all mock me because in my golf reports, I will quite often talk about which way the wind was blowing, or I will talk about something that has happened on the golf course, because I think that's color. And I think that helps the person in Ochterada or Ross and Cromarty or in Conway or wherever who is reading my paper the next morning. I think that those blobs of color that I put in are enabling the reader to get a mental picture of what it was like. And to me, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm linking the reader to the event that I'm covering. I don't want to get in the way if I can possibly help it, but I'm providing a tube from one to the other. And if I do it properly and people say to me, I've always liked your stuff because you put color into it, well, I glow with pride.
Well, John, as a grateful reader, I appreciate every single tiny piece of that color, because it really, it does. It takes you there. And I want to just follow up one more question on the Masters, because to me, it is one of the greatest sporting events in the calendar every year. Well, what do you think it is about the Masters that manages to conjure up a drama and, for you guys, an incredible story year after year after year?
Well, I think it's because it's the same golf course. It's a very testing golf course. You having been there, I'm prepared to bet that one of your first impressions was of how much movement of the land there is, that you had no idea that there was something like 130 feet between the highest and lowest points. Because that's what everybody says when they go there for the first time. That's not conveyed on television. The rise and fall of the golf course, the brilliance of the design of the holes, the fact that the players go there year after year after year so they can really get to know it very, very well. So they know that they can take on a shot around a corner. They know exactly that the height of the trees might look intimidating to a spectator, but they can get a 5-iron 10 feet above the top of that tree. They know all the wrinkles on the greens. And that, plus the decorum of having that we are regularly told about, you know, that no running, please show respect to your playing partners and all the sort of things that Bobby Jones stood for. Plus the magic ingredient of, and I don't know what that is, plus a magic ingredient.
I'll tell you what, the magic ingredient has to be the cheese and pimento sandwiches at $3. I mean,
no, Giles, no.
It's
the egg salad sandwich.
Absolutely with you, John.
Egg salad
for sure.
Is much better than cheese and pimento.
Well, I'm happy to arm wrestle that over an ultra-low beer as well. John, we've talked a lot about golf. I have to ask you this because I never have. And you write prolifically about the two sports that I probably do know a little bit about. You've identified the world's worst golfer. I'm going to ask you, who are the best five golfers you've ever seen? And then I'm going to ask you the same about rugby. And I know we might be looking back and it might be very Welsh and you and I might get very indulgent.
But Go for it.
I'm intrigued.
Okay. The best five golfers that I've seen, in no particular order, because that takes a bit more time to think, in no particular order that I've seen, Tiger Woods, Jack Nicklaus, Nick Faldo, Seve Ballesteros, and Arnold Palmer. And I don't want to put them in an order because that would take quite a long time. Each of them had something an appeal to me in a different way. Faldo, I liked Faldo, though many people didn't. I got to know him. He started playing good golf in about 1975. In 1980, when I started writing about golf, he and I were not quite the same age, but we were not that far apart. We were both relatively new to the scene, and we struck up a friendship that remained for quite a long time. And we used to have dinner together, and I remember having dinner with him on the eve of a US Open in Chicago. And this actually bears out the point I was making about making friends earlier with sportsmen. We had dinner together because we were both at a loose end, and this was long before the days when players brought along their trainer, their masseur, their psychiatrist, their psychologist, their manager, their coach and everything, and they all traveled in teams. Nick and I just sat down for dinner, and by one of those strange coincidences, on the eve of the, I think, 1990 US Open, I noticed that over his shoulder was a book, the title of the book was something like, not Who Dares Wins, because that's the Royal Marines, but it was He Who Dares Can Win, or words to that effect, or He Who Believes Can Win. And my piece that Saturday, 5 days after we had dinner together, after the third round of the US Open, which he would go on to fail to win by one stroke, was all about the symmetry of him sitting down for dinner on the Monday night with a book over his shoulder, which absolutely epitomized his attitude. He believed he could do it, and he went out and did it. Seve is my all-time hero because
Agreed.
he could never pronounce John. So I was either Yon or Hon. You know, the Spanish have trouble with the letter J. Now, I couldn't care less about being called Yon or Hon by Seve. He could call me the man in the moon, as far as I'm concerned, and I was just flattered. And he just engaged you. He was so daring and so brave, and he came along at exactly the same time as I did. Arnold Palmer, I've just written a long essay about, and Arnold was just extraordinary. Never, ever known to say no to an autograph hunter, and incidentally, always using impeccable writing. His penmanship was very slow and very thorough, but his thinking was, these people who are kind enough to ask me for my autograph need to know what my name is, so they've got to be able to read it. So his was always the most legible name on any kid's autograph book. So that's Seve, Faldo and Palmer. Nicholas, well, Jack was just so icily cold initially, so unbelievably competitive, yet as the years have gone by, he has become quite rightly a guardian of the game, really, and quite rightly says, fortunately, all the right things. And it's somehow appropriate that it was he who suggested that the Ryder Cup, in the days when it was Great Britain and Ireland against America, and Great Britain and Ireland were getting hammered every time. He suggested to Lord Derby, look, this is our boy's not really going to be up for this much longer. You've got to do something about it. And it was equally appropriate that on the famous occasion in 1969, he and Tony Jacklin were playing. Jacklin was a great young hero. He should concede that putt that tied the famous match in 69. He has somehow or other learned to put his foot in exactly the right place at the right time and to open his mouth and say exactly the right thing at the right time. So I admire him as much as a person as I did as a player. And have I forgotten anyone?
Just Tiger.
Oh, Tiger. Yeah, okay. I struggle with Tiger. I struggled with how he's much better since he has come back, but prior to that, I struggled with the way that he was so disobliging to sponsors, for example, and he would never allow his name to be publicly displayed or news of his entry into a tournament to be displayed or announced until the 59th minute of the 11th hour before the tournament entries closed. Why did he do that? I don't know. He I thought it was a really churlish thing. He was so churlish with so many journalists. He didn't engage with the fans. He was undoubtedly an absolutely wonderful golfer. No question of that. Perhaps the greatest golfer ever. But as a person, I didn't warm to him at all. And when he had his mea culpa in Jacksonville in 2010, I thought that was awfully sick-making, really, and stage-managed. And when he came back and he played at Augusta after that, that was his epiphany, really. He changed. From that moment till now, he's become a much nicer person. It's almost as if he's realized what everybody realizes, and that is he is mortal. There is a time, especially yes. if you're as good as Tiger was, when you think, I am immortal, I can do anything, nobody else matters, I'm wonderful. And then one day, something happens, and you realize, actually, I'm not Beautiful. Immortal, and I need these people.
Everybody who does sport should just know the tale of Daedalus and Icarus. I mean, it's as simple as that, isn't it? There comes a point where humanity kicks in. I just very quickly, top five rugby players, because I know you and I could talk about this all night, any evening, but I'm really interested, just off the top of your head.
Gerald Davis, simply because one night I saw him score four tries for Cardiff against Pontypool on a mud pitch of a night, when I believe he only touched the ball six times, and he got four tries. He, as near as anybody I've ever seen, he seemed to dance. He didn't glide. He was actually quite a jerky runner. Guscott glided. David Duckham glided.
Yes.
Probably some of the modern players glide. But Gerald danced, sort of picking his little feet delicately from one, avoiding one puddle after the other, and outstripping the defence to score in the corner. He'd be one. Gareth Edwards would be another. I think that Martin Johnson, for his sheer leadership qualities, never give in. No, I'm not moving my team back, ref. No, no, we're here. We're staying here. Just his sheer indomitability. I thought Mike Gibson was wonderful, though many people now would struggle to remember him. I watched him in a Lions game in 1977, and he was on the wing. And I remember I watched him very closely because it was a Wednesday game and I wasn't writing until Saturday. And I watched him, and there was one particular moment when he went off towards the right touchline and play moved across the field to the left. And I remember thinking, hello, what's going on here? What was going on was that about 15 or 20 seconds later, the ball was spun across the field to the right touchline where he was, and he went over and scored a try. And he just seemed to be otherworldly on a rugby field. He seemed to know what was going to happen moments before it happened. And then the last one would obviously be Barry John, who I knew a bit and whom I see around Cardiff now. And the famous story of him, of a BBC television crew making a film of him when he was a student. And in those days, you didn't have many cameras, and they had a tripod set up on the opposition line halfway between the post and the corner flag. And sure enough, at some point in the first half, Barry weaves his way through, dots the ball down, looks up at the camera and winks. And at half time, they assess the film that they have taken, and they realize that actually they missed it. Something was wrong with the camera at that stage. So they got word to him quickly, and he said, all right, don't worry about it, boys. And they set themselves up at the other end of the field, same position, and exactly the same thing happened again. He got the ball, he weaved his way through the defense, touched it down under the camera for the second time in the game, gave the viewers a big wink. An amazing performer.
John, that takes me on to what we call our sponsor question, which comes from Smart Sports. And the question is this. We've seen over recent years some new things creep into golf, whether it is Phil Mickelson hitting the ball before it stopped with his putter, whether it's slow play, or whether it's Matt Kuchar and trying to do things in a bunker. Surely golf needs to stop this kind of trend and hold on to some of the things you've reminded us of on this podcast.
I don't think that anything in life is quite as pure and as good, not necessarily as good, but the same as it was 25 years ago. And there's absolutely no reason why golf should be any better. It's populated by people. We are living at the moment in a orally violent society in which people can shout liar, liar at someone else in a way that you and I wouldn't, and makes my blood boil. Manners are not the same. I'm not going to say that they're better or worse. They're just not the same. It would be pompous of me to say they're worse. They're different. We have to expect things like these incidents to occur. I mean, and partly because there is extra money involved now, there's greater protection, there's greater policing of events. Can I tell you a story about Phil Mickelson?
Please.
Absolutely.
It involves the hitting the ball twice incidents. Yeah. I was in America, obviously, since I've done something like 140 successive major championships, and as it happens, a colleague and I were invited onto Fox Television into the studio, which was a tent 20 feet off the ground, just adjacent to the clubhouse at Shinnecock, the next day. And we were going to be asked to give an idea of what that Open was like and so on and so forth. And for some reason, I sat in the middle. I had my colleague on my right and I had the lady interviewer on my left. And I said to them at one point, look, we're obviously going to have to talk about Mickelson, aren't we? And she said, yes, of course we are. It'll probably be the first question. And she moved her chair a little bit nearer to me and gave me a slight nudge and said, you know, you can go for it, John, you can go for it. And I said, well, what do you mean I can go for it? I mean, I am thinking, I said, of saying, or rather, I said, could I call him a chump? Because what he did is it's a very British word. And they said, oh, well, we'd rather not. And I said, well, can I call him an ass? And they said, oh, no, 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 you can't. You could not even an ass. But we were waiting for an awfully long time in what you might call the go position whilst they went to, they didn't come to us. Then they were just about to come to us and they were dispatched somewhere else. And so on. Finally, the director in the studio, mock studio, said, right, we're with you in 10 seconds, John. And the lady interviewer gave me another nudge and said, go on, go on. And her first question, well, John, what we would like to know what you think about yesterday and Phil Mickelson and his hitting the ball twice and so on. And I said, well, I think I can probably use words that are acceptable on the floor of the House of Commons. And I would say he was a chump and an ass and a silly ass, a silly ass. Well, of course, we carried on for about, they then asked Ron, who was sitting on my right, what he thought, and that segment went on for another 4 minutes or so. By the time I got back to the media tent, which was probably 3 minutes after it had gone out on air, all my colleagues in the media tent were laughing and sort of poking fun at me a bit, and some of them, I think, quite admiringly that I'd said it. But the level of comment on social media, who the so-and-so does this long-vowed Englishman think he is talking about Mickelson like this? Why doesn't he F off back to Britain? I mean, it's an extraordinary level of abuse. But I had clearly caught the mood. Now, just to finish the story, I wrote to the producer afterwards and said, look, I'm sorry about that. I probably shouldn't have said it, though I do think that if language is acceptable on the floor of the House of Commons and has been for a good many centuries, it should be okay to be used 20 feet up in a tent on the edge of a golf course in New York. And he wrote back and he said, well, John, you may be right, but you had said you wouldn't say it. And I couldn't deny that. I mean, I was overcome with perhaps self-importance or something when this lady on my left, who was nudging me to be as risque as I could, I was overcome when she actually put the microphone in front of me. But sorry, the kicker to this is that was in June of last year, and in July at Carnoustie, I was loitering around the scorer's tent, and out came Phil Mickelson. Oh. And he talked to a colleague of mine for a moment, and then he sort of looked around, was a bit of a loose end. So I went straight up to him and I said, Phil, I'm John Hopkins. And Phil said, hi, John, how are you doing? And shook my hand. And I said, I have an apology to make to you. I am the chap who called you a chump and a silly ass on television. And he looked me straight in the face and he said, John, you have no apologies to make at all. I was completely in the wrong.
Wow.
I think that tells you quite a lot about Mickelson.
Yeah, that's great. And again, that takes you back to what I said earlier on. It's lovely to hear things like that about guys that you don't know what they're like in real life. You have this persona that is often, in the case of the likes of Tiger Woods, very carefully crafted. So it's always nice to hear that you know, away from the camera and away from all their managers, they're decent human beings. John, I have there's one question I'd love to ask you, and perhaps we can finish off with this. You know, we've talked a lot about the golfers you admire, the rugby players you admire. I'm interested in the writers you admire, the sports writers you admire. I was reading an anthology of Hugh McIlvaney's works a little while ago. It's a book I've read I don't know how many times. And I can read those stories over and over and over again. And so I'm curious to know which writers have had an impact on you, whether it's the, you know, the Herbert Warren Wins of the world, or the Grantland Rices back in the day, or the Paul Haywards, or the Henry Winters of today. I'd love to hear about some of the journalists that you've admired.
Okay. Well, I worked in America in the 60s. And I acquired a taste for American sports writing because I was able to get Sports Illustrated, which had then been going only for about 10 years. It started, I think, in the late 50s. That was very influential and remains so. I mean, I couldn't write like Dan Jenkins or Alfred Wright or any of the famous Frank DeFord, Curry Kirkpatrick, any of the famous writers. And I certainly couldn't write like Rick Riley, who is a modern star, but I could at least read their stuff and learn from it. I read a huge amount, and the people I like are, not surprisingly, the people who do what I think I do. I set out to write. If somebody says to me, what's it like being a golf writer? And I say, well, I'm not a person who writes about golf. I write about people who play golf. And I'm not a sports writer. I am a person who writes about people who do sport. And it's the people in the sport of whom I can paint a picture that will, with any luck, be sufficiently interesting for people to remember, A, the point I'm trying to make, and B, the style of my writing. So the writers I like are the ones who I feel do the same, just tell you a lot more than who did what to where, when, and how, and what they said. They flesh out the picture of the person that they're writing about. And Paul Haywards is an obvious example. Simon Barnes was a very distinctive writer. Matthew Syed is an extraordinarily successful arguer. You don't want to debate with Matthew because, as I heard someone say not so long ago, when he was being presented with an award, you might start off reading an article in which you think you've got an opinion that is different from his, but you, sure as anything, will end up agreeing with him. Hugh was terrific. Wooldridge was terrific. Jeffrey Nicholson. Now, there's an slightly unsung hero. He was a wonderful writer, but he was slightly overshadowed because at that time the Observer had McIlvaney and they had, so many great writers. But to my mind, Jeffrey was as good on any particular sport as anybody there's ever been. He just had he essentially was taught by Kingsley Amis at Swansea Grammar School. That to me, good writing is not just saying who did what, where, and when. It's fleshing out the story with blobs of color and stuff that, to go back to use a phrase I used before, indicates that you're there. But even if you're not there, it's just color. Just, you know, what does a person look like? Does he have a distinctive nose? Does he speak with a lisp? Is his left foot slightly deformed? Does he curl his little finger? As a journalist, you can't help looking for these things subconsciously, so that when you actually do notice that a man has only got one ear, say, you really want to try and work into your copy the fact that he has only got one ear. And then the reader at the other end of the tube that I talked about will have a more vivid picture. Those are the things I'm trying to do. And people who present the person in the round, that they are writing about in the round, rather than just as a Labour voter or a man sitting in Nottingham or a man who runs fast on a rugby pitch. But as people in the round, they're the writers I admire.
John, it's amazing to hear you speak like this, not only because of your recollections, but I think for anybody who listens to our podcast, you've just given a masterclass in the art of sports writing, which I think a lot of people, it's an art that I believe is not perhaps as great as it used to be. And I think that the joy of great narration, whether it be commentary or the written word or radio commentary, whatever it may be, has painted so many pictures for sports fans all over the world. And you are one of those breed. And on a personal level, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show. You've been a very, very good friend of mine over the years and will be for many more. But to hear you talk about your skill, your trade and your craft in those ways, particularly the last 10 minutes, is a real privilege.
Yes, John.
Well, I'm flattered. Thank you.
John, I'd like to echo that. And for some of the people that maybe don't know, we've had on the show today a guest who, when he decided to step back a little bit from writing about golf, received a written letter from Arnold Palmer to thank him for his work. That doesn't happen very often. So thank you, John. It's been a privilege.
Yeah, John, and I just add my voice to the chorus. Thank you so much. I've loved every second of this. I've had to keep reminding myself to ask questions. I've been so enthralled sitting listening to the answer. So thank you so much.
John, thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege. Thank you very much indeed. And I'm sorry I've gone on a bit long, but Giles knows we're both the same. We're both Welsh windbacks.
That's perfect. Just perfect. Thank you.
Oh, can we do that again? Can we have him on again next week?
Yeah, we just scratched the surface, I think.
Oh, man, I loved that. I absolutely loved every second of that.
Do you know, it's so much of what he says and what we talk about, and I think what so many of the listeners will feel, is that sense that sport is not just about what we see in front of us, but also the interpretation, whether it's the interpretation of the crowd, the written word, that the commentator, as I was saying earlier. It's that is the magic of why sport can be entertaining, not entertainment, as I've sort of bang on about a bit. And I think listening to someone whose craft is to paint that picture for those who aren't there, for me, just reminds me why this is such a bloody good industry to be involved in, why it's such a joy.
Well, that's Charles. I think to me that's the point. If you're a fan of sport, any single sporting event that you're sitting at home watching on TV, the chances are you wish you were there, and it's the skill of people like John that give you really the only chance you have to really feel like you are there. And if you can write in such a way as to make people feel that they really were there, and it does come down to little details about the wind and those little conversations aside, and it's because they're the things you could only experience if you were there. So it's such a skill, it's such an art, and John really is a master at it.
I think coming back to the very start of the show when we talked about the humanity of our heroes and sport, then I just felt that for an hour and 10 minutes there, it was enchanting to think about all these examples that he's seen, that he's been, as he said, so close that he could hear them speaking. I'm just not even going to talk about, well, how the world's changed now and how sport needs to evolve. I'm not going to even bother this week. That was just beautiful.
Hear, hear. Well, look, all that remains is to sadly wrap this up. Now, well, obviously, we completely forgot to ask John about his Twitter handle. Charles, do we know what John's Twitter handle is? I was just a total fan. I just got completely wrapped up in it.
Hang on. What, you just talk amongst yourselves. I'll get his it's at John Hopkins Golf.
At John Hopkins Golf. There we go. So look, please, if you're listening to the podcast and you haven't already looked for John on Twitter to follow him, I'd be astounded. But there you go. That's how you can do it. In the meantime, you can follow us, as always, at, you'll find us at Entertained R. That's the word, A-R-E, Entertained R. You can follow me at T-T-M-Y-G-H.
You can follow the captain at Giles Morgan 71.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, what a thrill. Should we do it again next week?
Yes.
Thanks. See you then. Bye-bye.
Take care.